Welcome all. Yes, it's February 4th, 2019. This is the second of our classes on Rabbi Chaim Michal Epstein, Yarach HaShulchan. Before we start, and there's a lot that needs to be said today, all sorts of interesting things. I'm going to even make the argument if we get to it. Well, let's wait till we get there. But all I can tell you is that once. I'm going to tell you what I'm going to tell you. I once said somewhere, and someone thought basically I was an anti-Semite for saying it. But I think after I explain it all, I think most people, if not everyone, will agree that far from being what I'm saying is anti-Semitic, it's actually the truth of what happened. And I just throw that out there to keep you in suspense to stay on to the end. I do have to be. I want to pick up on a couple of questions we had last time, and also something which maybe was my fault for not explaining it properly. I spoke about something that I which is actually public knowledge in the yeshiva world, actually not in the academic world, but in the yeshiva world. But I saw, based on well, just comments and things, that. It's not that well known, and what I said was shocking to some people, perhaps even more shocking than what I'm going to say later. So let me explain. What I mean when I say was shocking, I spoke about the Makor Baruch, which is the biography. It's the work. It's everything from an autobiography, from a biography of different Gedolim. It's all sorts of Torah writings from a Baruch HaLevi Epstein. And I said a number of the son of the Aruch Shulchan. And I said a number of things about him that cast his accuracy in doubt and raised questions about him. And I mentioned a number about plagiarism, all sorts of things. And I probably should have explained something a little more because some people were shocked. And one question I received was, what's going on here? Isn't he one of the Gedolim? So let me talk a little bit about Reb Baruch Epstein just for a couple of minutes because we're using him, we'll continue to use him for what he talks about. This is the son of the Aruch HaShulchan, who incidentally was not a, he was a banker. He was not a practicing rabbi. He was killed in the Holocaust in Pinsk. But on the one hand, this is a very strange situation because on the one hand, Reb Baruch HaLevi Epstein is the Torah Tamima. The Torah Tamima is one of the most popular Chumashim available. And who doesn't have a Torah Tamima in their library? And it's very helpful. Before there's a Torah Shlema, he gave you all the, or most of the Mamre Chazal, and then he has the commentary. He also wrote the Makor Baruch, which, leaving aside the biographical stuff, is full, in four volumes, it's full of unbelievably interesting points and comments on different aspects of Jewish life, history, Torah. And yet, for a long time now, for even almost 100 years now, people have recognized that there are real problems with his writings. There's plagiarism, and this isn't something that any academics discovered. My experience has been in the academic world, they know nothing about this. This is something that comes right out of the Torah world, right out of the Lithuanian Torah world, that there's plagiarisms, there's untrue stuff. Statements, there's statements that are exaggerations, there's statements that he must have known were untrue and he said them anyway. And this is the sort of thing that inside the yeshiva world, you can Google it, you can see this. There's been articles written about this in the Torah world, there's Sfarim that deal with this, the Rabbi Kasher gives a whole list of examples of plagiarisms and distortions, Rabbi Feldman in his book Meshivas Nefesh, and numerous other examples. So what do you do here? You have a great Torah scholar, and then you have this other side. I don't have an answer for you. It's one of these strange situations, one of these strange examples of, on the one hand, you have a great Torah scholar, and on the other hand, you have aspects of, I don't know, call it his other life or something, in which there are things that just don't add up. I don't know what else to say about it, but that's the situation. So I'm sorry if I didn't give that as a preference. As I said, this isn't something that's something shocking from the academic world. This comes right out of the Torah world that the great Torah Tamima also had another side, which is more problematic. And as Moshe from Lakewood says, his own publisher accused him. He actually, I can send anyone who's interested, he published a little booklet. The man who supposedly helped him write it, accusing the Torah Tamima, accusing Rebbe Epstein of actually stealing his material. So it's a complicated situation. It's not the only example. We have other examples of it. If you come on my Greece trip, I'll speak a little bit about the Rabbi of Arta, Rabbi Binyamin Zev Arta, the author of the Tshuvot, the Binyamin Zev. You think one of the Gedolei Yisrael, and yet there are big problems with him as well in terms of plagiarism and all sorts of things. People are complicated, and that's all I'll say about this for now, unless we do classes on Rav Baruch HaLevi Epstein. Towards the end, David Eisen from Beit Shemesh, who's again, thank you for getting up so early, asked a few questions and in response, and I didn't have the answer. I said I'd research it, and in response to it, I said something which, with all these the marriages of the Nitziv and everything, it's all confusing. I got confused because in response to him, he asked me, was the Nitziv the Shadchan? And actually, the Nitziv was not the Shadchan. At least there's no evidence that the Nitziv was the Shadchan. But in describing that, I said, and his wife was from Bobruisk. I don't know what I was thinking. Of course, his wife wasn't from Bobruisk, the Aruch HaShulchan. The Aruch HaShulchan's wife was the sister of the Nitziv. She was from Volozhin, and when he was in Volozhin, that's when he met her. Now, he also asked me about a possible story that the Aruch HaShulchan had to go into business because the money was lost that he was supposed to be given. And there is such a story, not exactly that, but there's actually two versions of the story. One version of the story is that money, which the father of the Nitziv, that is the father-in-law of the Aruch HaShulchan, had Yaakov Berlin, had put aside to support him from learning for some years, that was given to someone to invest it or whatever, and this person lost the money. That's one version of the story. Actually, that it says that the Aruch HaShulchan went and Rav Yaakov Berlin didn't demand it back. So either the story ends there, or the other version is that the Aruch HaShulchan himself went to demand the money back and came back with the money. So the story that David heard would only apply to the first one. But in any case, this is would only be temporary. The father-in-law was only going to support him for a couple of years. The question then is, why didn't he go into the Rabbonus? He could have gone into Rabbonus, but he went into business. That was the plan. Like his father was in business. But while he was in business, he becomes a dayan, and things just lead to him becoming a rabbi. So it's not like his whole, at most, it would have been a couple years, assuming the version is correct that the money was lost. One final thing about Rav Baruch HaLevi Epstein, his version of the story, because someone asked me to expand a little bit. Let me just, you can find it on your own, but it's in volume 3 of the Makor Baruch. Chapter 20. That's where Baruch Epstein says that his father went to the Tzemach Tzedek, Menachem Mendel Schneerson of Lubavitch. By the way, if you come on my Central European trip, you'll learn about the first Tzemach Tzedek. Everyone knows that Tzemach Tzedek, the Rebbe of Chabad, but in rabbinic literature, that's Tzemach Tzedek the first and Tzemach Tzedek the second. And the first Tzemach Tzedek, we're going to go to the city, Nikolsburg. His name is Ramanacha, many important figure. He tells how his father spent over a month with the Tzemach Tzedek, which, as I mentioned, Munshine sees this. I'll read you a couple things. He says completely ridiculous. But here's the passage. It's on page 619, in which the Tzemach Tzedek supposedly says, of course, it is impossible, that he says that we as Hasidim, we don't know and are not able to appreciate the very great thing, the good chesed hagadol, that the Grod did for us by disputing with us. And people don't appreciate how much toda, how much thanks we owe him. And for the other disputants, the baalei machlokas, he calls them. And then he explained, because without the dispute, there's a real fear that the shita chadasha, that is Hasidut, the new idea, would have gone slowly and slowly off the path. And it would have led to a complete destruction because people would have been so involved, he says, with Kabbalah. You think of Shabtai Tzvi, etc. And they'd be so involved, he says, with the Kabbalah that the Nigla Talmud would have been forgotten. And the mitzvot Maaseiot, that is practical commandments, would have been unimportant. And he says we would have lost our way, Chalila. And therefore, the Machlokes against us was the best thing that happened to us. And then he goes further and says that the Shulchan Aruch of the Baal HaTanya, Rishneir Zalman, he says, I know for sure that it only was a creation of this dispute that he had to bring the Hasidim who were becoming distant from Torah, from Halacha. He wrote this Shulchan Aruch to keep them in the Halachic fold and to the Torah of the Nigla, the open Torah, make it more important for them. And then he says, Ad kan divrei Rav. This is what the Tzemach Tzedek said. Now, as I mentioned last week, the whole thing is nonsensical. What he says, first of all, about the Shulchan Aruch is completely nonsensical because that was written before that, even before there was any of the great Machlokas. Let me read you what Munshine says about point. First of all, he takes apart this idea that they spent a month there. He says that the reason for the Makar Baruch, the whole story, was any questions? Just put it to send it. The reason for the whole story is he says that the Hasidim never accepted the Aruch HaShulchan as a book of halacha, and therefore to create this whole story. This is different. What I told you last week was not correct. This is what he says. I was doing it from memory. To create this whole, he creates a whole story showing how the Tzemach Tzedek respected the Aruch HaShulchan, and that was, he according to Munshine, Reb Baruch Epstein's way to make the Aruch HaShulchan as an accepted text for the Hasidim as well. He then goes on and talks about the strange things that he puts in the mouth of the Aruch HaShulchan. And then he says that the Shulchan Aruch of the Baal HaTanya was started when he was in Mezrich, because the Magid told him to start it, and that was before the great Vilna, the Machlokas in Vilna, etc. So that's for those who asked. That's the summary of the issue here. Now, so Moshe from Lakewood. That's exactly, you said it before I saw you said it. That's what Munshine says. Okay, now let's return to where we were left off. And since I just mentioned Reb Baruch, let me say one more thing about it. Something which is strange, which I always found strange. And then I noticed that Henkin, Eitam Henkin, Hashem Yikom Damo, he points it out also. The entire fourth volume, basically, or most of it, I think it's almost basically the entire one, focuses on the Nitziv. There's, and he refers to him, as I mentioned, as Dodi v'Gisi, my uncle and my brother-in-law. There's only a few chapters, just a very limited amount in the Makor Baruch, four giant volumes that deal with his own father, Aruch HaShulchan. And I always found it strange what's going on here. He's giving much more attention to the Nitziv. Now, granted, if his father was not an important person, of course he'd give more attention to the Nitziv. But his father was an unbelievably important person. Granted, he wasn't a Rosh Yeshiva, but he was. Not only was he an outstanding posek, we'll talk about his role as a posek, in addition to talk about some of his interesting psakim, we're going to talk about the interesting phenomenon that's taken place over the last 30 years, how the Aruch HaShulchan and why it's been overshadowed by the Mishneh Berurah. But in his lifetime, the Aruch HaShulchan was the posek, not the Mishneh Berurah. And the Aruch HaShulchan was also one of the leaders of the Lithuanian Torah community, which means the Lithuanian Jewish community as a whole as well. In ways that the Nitziv was not. So why is it that his father gets so much less discussion there? Henkin sees this as a proof, and I have to say that it makes sense to me the way he describes it, that he did not have a close relationship, Reb Baruch, with his father. The Nitziv was more influential on him. As Henkin goes through the dates, as a youngster, before he was bar mitzvah, he left home. He goes to Volozhin, where he is for a couple of years, and he then returns. Then he goes to Vilna, and then he goes back to Volozhin, and he marries in 1878. So That is the Makar Barach. In other words, during his crucial years, his teen years and everything, he was only with his father a few times. It wasn't like today, you talk on the phone and everything. He was with the Netziv day in and day out for years, and he occasionally saw his father through those years. And furthermore, Henkin points out, and this I never paid, this I actually never noticed, that in his Torah writings as well. Of course, as the we all know the his book the Torah Tamima, but he has other writings. He has commentary Baruch Sha'amar on the Siddur. His commentary, he has commentary on Torah as well. Just a separate commentary, not the Torah. Torah Tamima is really like a commentary on the rabbinic passages. He has his own commentary as well. He hardly ever mentions his father, even in times when he deals with halachic matters and his father has important halachic rulings. You'd expect him to mention his father. He doesn't, so it raises questions. It is very strange. As I said, I'll get Moshe. We'll start with your questions when I get Tosefet Bracha. Yes, thank you. We'll get at the end. I'll come back unless it's really vital. Well, Moshe asked, wasn't there? I said that he started the Shulchan Aruch before the Great Dispute, and he says, wasn't there? Dispute before. What Munshine is saying is the great dispute when the Grug gets involved and the Cheirim, and when the Grug turns away Rav Shneur Zalman, refuses to see him. That he says, he started the Shulchan Aruch before that, so there wouldn't have been any reason for writing a Shulchan Aruch. These were minor figures opposing them. That's what Munshine says, at least. Again, we don't have to, the whole story. Story is nonsensical from its beginning. The very notion that anyone in Hasidus could say that the Groz opposition, and which was vicious, he said, basically putting him in Cheirim to drive them out of the towns and everything, no one could say that. Now, it is true that when the Groz dies, there were certain Hasidim who rejoiced over that. You can imagine they're rejoicing over the death of their persecutor. And Shneur Zalman writes a letter, this, you can't do this, that we still have to respect the Grug. It raises the interesting question that, what is your, when people attack you, what is your response? Nussin Slifkin, he's declared, let's say he's declared a heretic by a certain great rabbi. Is he then permitted to treat this rabbi also with disrespect? Because, does it say anywhere that if someone thinks I'm a heretic, that I still need to treat him well? It's interesting, but Rav Shneur Zalman did say, yes, we have to respect him. The same respect was not shown for others, such as Rav Avigdor, the famous Rav Avigdor, who's really gave testimony before the Russian government and led to all sorts of terrible things for Rav Shneur Zalman and Hasidus as a whole. That they didn't have this feeling, but the Gro was so outstanding. This issue, which I raised, we spoke about it before with the Satmar Rebbe, and there's a, I'm going to be publishing something. Not well. I'll give you more details later. But there's a tshuva of Rav Henkin that deals with this very matter in B'nai Vanim. Because what about the Satmar Rebbe? If the Satmar Rebbe thinks says you're a heretic, if assuming he says that, I argued that there's probably a level of rhetoric here. Just because he says you're a heretic, I don't know if he really meant you're a heretic. But let's assume he really did say you're a heretic. Do you then need to show respect for someone who says you're a heretic? If my Rebbe is Rav Kook and the Satmar Rebbe, who did say Rav Kook's a heretic, do I still need to show respect for Rav Shach? I mean, these are interesting questions, and for another time, perhaps. We dealt with it in classes on the Satmar Rebbe. Okay, returning to our discussion, I mentioned that he goes to. The first shela, the first rabbinic position is in Novozibkov, that city I spoke about last week. And while there, let me see if I have a title page here. No, I didn't print out that title page. While there, he publishes his first book. It's called Or LeYesharim, or Or LeYesharim. It's a commentary on a section of an important work, which only appeared in a good edition and completely in our day. Or our generation, generation before us, perhaps, the Sefer HaYashar of Rabbeinu Tam, Now, the Sefer Yashar is a work for Talmudists, Talmidei Chachamim. It's obviously a work of a Rishon, know Rabbeinu Tam from Tosfot, but this is an important commentary, halachic work by Rabbeinu Tam. I've quoted it many times for the simple reason that in the introduction there, he says important things that the Cheirim, there's a Rabbeinu Tam as a Cheirim against anyone who makes corrections in the Talmud text. That is, you're studying Gemara. In those days, it was all in manuscript, and you see what appears to be an obvious error. So the reason we have so many different versions is because every person studying and every scribe, they came across what was an error, and they corrected it. They inserted a different thing. Well, you might think it's a problem, and you can't understand it, but that doesn't mean that someone else can. So you can't, if you have a correction, you have to put it on the side. You can't change the actual words of the text because then, we're not going to have a Torah anymore because everyone's going to be making changes. We know you can't do that with the Torah, but with Gemara, there's plenty of people who thought of that. And that's why I said the last time I quoted this in one of my blog posts, I said that Art Scroll is under the Cheirim of Rabbeinu Tam because they said, that there's certain, the Rashbam, you can't. It doesn't make sense what the Rashbam says. He couldn't have written it, etc. So what you're supposed to do is you're supposed to put a note. I'm talking about the first chapter of Bereishit. You're supposed to put a no comment in the bottom saying it's difficult, Sarachim, I don't understand, etc. You're not allowed to do exactly what Rabbeinu Tam says you can't do. You can't cut it out and say that I know that he couldn't have said it. That's what Rabbeinu Tam says. You can't take a passage in the Gemara or anyone and say it couldn't be said, so we're going to cut it out. You can't do that. There's also a section of this commentary which has been lost, of Sefer Yashar. On the very first pages of the commentary, the first page really, you have the approbation, the haskama of two Hasidic figures. Very strange. Rav Aaron and Rav Menachem Mendel of Chernobyl. And only then do you get to the Lithuanian Gedolim. So here you have a Lithuanian Talmud Chacham. And what does he do? He puts the first Haskamot, Hasidic Rebbes, who, with, I don't think it would be disrespectful to Hasidim, for the Hasidim are listening, to say that Hasidic Rebbes, they're not really known for spending their times, in Sefer Yashar of Rabbeinu Tam. They have all sorts of other good characteristics. But that's not one of the things. That's not part of the job description. There's Dayanim, there's plenty of big Talmidei Chachamim in the Hasidic world. But this isn't something that the Rebbe needs to be doing, so to have them. But there's a reason for that. If you recall, I mentioned that in Novozibkov, there's two types of Hasidim who were there. There's Chabad, and the other were Chernobyl. So I'm not sure why there's no Haskama from a Chabad rabbi, but he wanted the leaders of the Chernobyl dynasty. Only on the next page does he have the Lithuanian Gedolim. Now, Yehuda Leib Maimon, who was one of the students, Musmachim of the Aruch HaShulchan, he says that this, although I can't find any evidence other than what he says, but he says that this was regarded in the Lithuanian Torah world as very disrespectful. Disrespectful to the Gedolim. And Maimon says, in many copies of this book, the haskamot of the Hasidic rabbis are ripped out. And all you have is the Lithuanian Gedolim. Now, could be. Maimon, the problem with Maimon is that he says a lot of important stuff, a lot of good stuff, but he too has a vivid imagination. If you know his, I think it's five or six volumes of, his stories of Gedolim. But I checked three copies of the book, two on Hebrew books and one on Otzer HaChachma, and it's actually just the reverse. Only one of them has the haskamot of the Lithuanian rabbis, which include the Netziv and Rav Yitzchok and Spector, and all three of them have the Hasidic rabbis. So here you have two copies. Maybe the Hasidim were upset because the Lithuanians ripped out the Hasidic haskamot, so the Hasidim therefore ripped out the Litvisha Haskamos, and just so happens that the copies we have on HebrewBooks.org, they're two copies in which the Lithuanians are ripped out. Could be, I don't know. But once I read what Maimon says, I went online to check it, and it's a little striking That's just the reverse. It's the Lithuanian Haskamot that are ripped out. I could, what Maimon says does make sense. I mean, if you're a Lithuanian Torah person, obviously it hardly needs to be said that the Nitziv and Rabbi Yitzchak Inspector goes before Hasidic Rebbe and his son. I mean, for the Hasidic world, it doesn't, but for the Lithuanian Torah world, I mean, even to ask for a Haskama on a Torah book from a Hasidic Rebbe, the only time you would do that is if the Hasidic Rebbe was himself a great Torah scholar and his Hasidic Rebbeship is quite apart from that, like the Minchas HaLazer of Munkach or the Chabad rabbis who are always great, or the Ger Rebbe. But just to ask a Hasidic Rebbe, it's never done. So he's there for a few years. I forget exactly how many years. More than a few, I believe. I'm forgetting now the exact number of years. In it's not important. No, Nov Zepkov. And from there he goes to Novardik, Lithuanian city, Novardik. Now, I think everyone listening to us now has heard of Novardik. If you haven't, so let me say a bit about Novardik. Novardik is known from Jewish. Look, Novardik had many great rabbis. There's a even before the Aruch HaShulchan, there's a great. I'll test the people here because I have people, not just Moshe. There's other people who are very learned here. There, the Rav of Novardik before the Aruch HaShulchan. I'm not saying that he was the one directly before. I think two or three before wrote an important work of responsa that to this day is used. So see if anyone knows this. Yes, okay, but the name David of Novardik. The name of the book, though, our Torah scholars are not known by their names often. They're known by the name of the book. Yes, so we got it there. The Galia Maseches. Okay, so we got real learned people here. That's what it says in Pirkei Avos. Sometimes these guys who are writing in, they don't want to show me up, so they'll send me privately. They'll send me emails pointing things out. But I'm fully in recognition of the fact that there's some of these people who listen to us. I'm very thankful, know more about a lot of these, about certain things, I should say, at least than I do. And it's a great zechut, merit for me that they teach me also. Okay, so he goes to Novardik. Novardik, though, is known through Jewish history because it's the center of the Musar movement of a certain sort. You have, of course, the Rishon Salanter, and then you have the students. And then you have a branch of it that's known as Novardik. Novardik, if you want to get a sense of Novardik, well, first of all, there's a very nice article by David Fishman on Novardik. But Chaim Grada, great image. If you want to know about the Chazon Ish and about Novardik, you can read Chaim Grada's works, The Yeshiva. Now, Novardik was controversial because Novardik moved off in its own way. Standard Musar adopts the approach of what they call Gadlus HaAdam. You know, humanity is a creation of God, and you have to build them up and understand so they understand how great they are and they can achieve greatness. That's why it was important, as we've spoken in previous classes, to dress well and all these things that we know. But then there was another approach. They called it Shiflus Adam, degradation, I guess you could say, of man, to know a different approach to recognize how puny you are, how insignificant. And they had all sorts of strange practices. They wear clothes with holes in it and dirty. And eventually, I believe also Moshe Silberg, I think, speaks about Novardik. Eventually, it calmed down a bit. I don't even look, there's a Novardik yeshiva today in Brooklyn. I don't know if any of the old extremism in Novardik still remains, but many of the other Musar people, maybe even most of them, thought that Novardik was a complete distortion. Rabbi Yoizel, he sat for a time in a room with, they called him the man of the holes, you know, one hole in it, in the door to put his milchik food in, and the other to put the fleishik food in. And when you look at the attacks against the Musar movement, often they focus on Novardik, on the craziness they thought of Novardik. And when I say the attacks, I'm talking about attacks, as we'll see, from Rabbanim and also from the Maskilim. It is the case, I mean, it's not the case that Torah scholars not come out of Novardik. The Stipler, you can't get much bigger Torah scholar than the Stipler. He learned in Novardik. Yet even in his day, you had these strange things going on in Novartic. And as I said, I invite anyone to look. They wore their tzitzis out, long tzitzis. They grew beards. Who grew beards in the Lithuanian yeshiva? Who wore their tzitzis out? Today, of course, it's very different. But no one in the Lithuanian yeshivas wore their tzitzis out. That's how yeshiva bachur looks like, a shirt coming out like that. That's not the way you dress. This is one of the changes, incidentally. Even in Radin, the Chafetz Chaim seems to say, it's not clear, that you should have your tzitzis out. But we have Edut Ne'amana, testimony from people from Radin. In Radin, the Bacharim did not wear their tzitzis out despite what the Chafetz Chaim writes. And incidentally, it's not so clear that the Chafetz Chaim is saying that. It could be that the Chafetz Chaim, when he talks about the tzitzis being out, he's referring to that, they used to wear the garment over it. So if you're wearing the tzitzis over your garb, then don't put the tzitzis in your pockets or in your clothes. But if you're wearing a tzitzis under the shirt, it could be the Chafetz Chaim isn't referring to that. The Rav Abadi, I think it's the very first responsa in his Or Yitzchak, says that that's what the Chafetz Chaim means, although that's not the general understanding. So he becomes rabbi in Novartic. It has to be said that many of the attacks on the Novartic yeshiva were based on false information, distortions. And who would know better than that? None other than the people living in Novartic. During the Great Dispute over the Musar movement, and there's an entire book. I have it here. I actually got the reprint years ago. Almost on Musar from Dov Katz. You can see it on HebrewBooks.org. You can even print it. You can click on a button, and then you get a nice volume, soft cover or hardcover, given to you. This book was printed in doesn't have the date on the in seven or 1970, I think. And he waited to print this. First, he did five volumes of the Musar movement, and Rabbi Yechiel Yaakov Weinberg wrote to him, and he publishes the selection of this letter, saying that if you're going to talk about the Musar movement, you have to be honest historically and talk about the opposition to the Musar movement. And this is a great book, although he's a partisan of Musar, Dov Katz from Slobodka. He includes all the arguments. He goes on for pages. If there's an article by a big rabbi or a maskil, he actually cites the entire article, recognizing that who has access to hamelitz and all these things, especially years ago, before the internet. So it's a very important and very helpful book, and he deals with it at great length. And on page, for example, on 126, 127, he prints here, which appeared that the Haskalah newspapers, or the quasi-Haskalah newspapers, when you call a newspaper like hamelitz Haskalah, it's not Haskalah like you think of, like irreligious, because the big rabbanim used to publish for it also. It had both the maskilim and the rabbanim. It's not like the Jewish, maybe I wouldn't say it's like the Jewish Week, because the Jewish Week will publish, for those in the New York area, will also publish ads for non-kosher restaurants. So no one, everyone who's, they're all basically Shomer Shabbos, but you had liberals, and it was a place where they all could have conversations, like which could not happen necessarily in Poland or in Hungary. But he prints here from Hatzafira, another Haskalah newspaper, which of the first of all, the Nichbadei Ir Novartik, that is the machers, the important people from Novartik, saying that the city is in an uproar here after this article that appeared, attacking the Musarniks. In so it goes on to say that in all the article, there is not even a tiny bit of truth in it. There's no sect here. There's no shita, no separate things. All we have here in our city are Talmidei Chachamim who are sitting and learning b'shkeda atzuma shasu poskim. In other words, they were described in this article as the so-called yeshiva Novartik with a bunch of crazy people. They're completely distorting what it means to be a traditional Jew. And the people who live in the city write back and saying it's not true at all. And by the way, actually, it's not the person who wrote this article is a rabbi, because they say we were shocked to see that one who sits on a kisei hara, that he's a rav in the city, makes achilah shemaitis. And following this of the six machers in the city, then none other than the Archa Shochar, Bechiel Michel Epstein, he adds on his own pieces. He says that I was shocked to see how this motzi shemra, this false information, was stated not about etzim va'avonim, not about I guess immaterial things or material things, but about tamei chametzuyanim or l'dorsh al tibi yameinu kach. Woe is to our generation that a man who sits on a kisei hara would speak such minos and apikorsos. What does that mean? Saying that this rabbi, who is it? The rabbi, I forget now. I think it's yes, you know who it is? Avraham Aaron Borstein. Avraham Aaron Borstein is not an insignificant person. He's a he's he was known as the Rav of Tavrig, and then he was one of the leading attackers, opponents of the Musar movement. He goes to Eretz Yisrael, and he becomes a Rosh Yeshiva in which yeshiva? Let's see if I guys know it. Just for like 2 years. And then he dies, unfortunately, dies somewhat young. Rosh Yeshiva, yes, and Moshe, what can you do? Merkas Harav. He was a Rosh Yeshiva in Merkas Harav, and he was one of the Gedolim, real Gedolim in Lundus in Lithuania. And, but he was so, but what is it? What is the Archa Shochan? He called, so he's saying that. Saying that he doesn't say he's an apikoros, he's speaking minos and apikorsos. So what? He criticized the Nevarik Yeshiva? How does that make you a min or an apikoros? Because what is the Gemara? He doesn't say this, but this is what he means, in my opinion. What does the Gemara say to define an apikoros? One who's disrespectful to Torah scholars. So here you have the Rav of Tavrig, who at this time he was not yet in, he was in Ritava. So he wasn't a Rav in Tavrig. You're right. He was from Tavrig. He was, I mean, he wrote this article called Chevra Mistura, like a secret sect in Israel. He's disrespectful to Rabbanim and to Talmidic and Talmudic scholars who are involved with the Nevardic Yeshiva. That's apikorsis. And he goes on and says, what does the Aruch HaShulchan say? We see, that is, we live here. Einenu ro'os, we see, and we're happy. The Simchas HaTorah. That year, we're happy with the joy of Torah. Would that me tain vitrabu kamo b'Yisrael, that we hope there should be more like these Nevardic yeshivas, and anyone who speaks about negative about them, get out, we say. It's and then he mentions that it's reported that the Aruch HaShulchan said that would it be that after 120 years, I would be together with them. And then he quotes one of the Dayanim of Nevardic. The point is that here you have this Yeshiva Nevardic, which the outsiders are saying is it's like a madhouse. It's a place of crazy people. And but the people in the city who have nothing to do with the Nevardic Yeshiva, the Balabatim, who would be the first one. If there was some madhouse arising in their city, they'd be the first ones to want to get rid of it. But they come to its defense. And the Rabbanim of the city, the Aruch HaShulchan, one of his Dayanim, they say that we're here and we see it. All we see are students studying Torah, Gemara, Poskim. So, I mean, that was a very powerful defense of the Nevardic Yeshiva. And for any outsider, you would think that would put an end to the discussions. But it didn't. I mean, they're the people who are there to speak, to testify to it, but it didn't. Now, Dov Katz elsewhere quotes the Aruch HaShulchan as saying that he doesn't agree with everything advocated by the Nevardic Yeshiva, everything advocated from Rabbi Yoizel, but when he goes into the yeshiva and he sees how they're learning, all of his complaints are shelved. It reminds me, since we mentioned Merkaz, let me tell you something about Merkaz. Merkaz people don't. I'm very friendly with someone from Merkaz who was very close to Avraham Shapiro and was even a secretary. I told him the story. They don't like the story. None of the Merkaz people like this story, but it's true. And it's not just about Avraham Shapiro. Well, let me just type about Avraham Shapiro. Avraham Shapiro, Rosh Yeshiva Merkaz, wanted the students at Merkaz to dress like other yeshiva students. If you've ever been to Merkaz, you know the whole settlement movement. They wear regular clothes. Even the Sephardim now would dress like Ashkenazim with the white and black. Rav Avram Shapiro thought that today, it's not that white and black is holy or anything like that. It's just that today, that's the levush of yeshiva students. It's interesting that in the Haredi world, it's now the levush, it's the garment for everyone. It used to be that yeshiva students had a garb. In Europe, no one dressed like a yeshiva student, only yeshiva students. So now, as I've mentioned the stories in the past, I've told you how today you see people who look like, they have a black hat and the suit and all that. You think they look like Talmud Chacham, you speak to them for 2 minutes and you see they don't know anything. But that's a new phenomenon. But Rav Avram Shapiro thought that he wanted the Bachurim at Mir Kazarav. So, for example, on Shabbos, you don't just have a white shirt, you have a suit and a hat, a whole bit. But the students refused to go along with it, and Rav Tzvi Yehuda never really had an issue. He thought that the way they dressed were fine. That's the way that you should dress in Eretz Yisrael. But Tzvi Yehuda thought that if you become a Rav, you should wear the levush. And if you know a picture of Tzvi Yehuda, he always wore the black hat. But for the Talmidim, he didn't think he needed to. So Rav Avram Shapiro said, though, that, and this is recorded in one of the biographies of him, that although he wanted the students to dress like the other yeshiva students, because that's become the standard now, whenever he would walk into the Beis Medrash and see the way they were intensively learning, then he said, it's sort of, he said to himself, well, there's really no need for it. Because he would come to the Beis Medrash intending maybe to speak to them, they should dress differently, but when he saw the way they were learning, he shelved it, even though he himself thought it would be better. And that's what the Aruch HaShulchan says. He actually has things he disagrees with in the Varik Yeshiva. When he goes into the Beis Medrash and sees the way they are, then he closes his mouth and doesn't say anything because they're intensively learning. Now, how many students were there? I found the figures for this. At this time of the Aruch HaShulchan, at least we're told, there were some 300 students in the yeshiva and a kollel of some 60 students. And of course, the Navarik yeshiva becomes important, especially in Poland, because it isn't just Navarik. They send out branches all over the place. It becomes a whole company, or I don't know what you call it, a whole industry of different branches. The Rebbe Chiya, let me just take the story a little bit further, because the Aruch HaShulchan's successor, incidentally, there is this version of the biography that says he was at another place before he comes to Nevardik, but I don't really think there's any evidence that. I think this is above my. So the story is he goes to this other little town, and then the people in Nevardik go to this town and say, "We want you as our rabbi." I don't believe it's true. I think he went right from Novozibkov to Nevardik, but when he leaves Nevardik, he's another important rabbi takes his place. So, does anyone know who took his place? Or not when he leaves, his successor in Nevardik. The Rav in Nevardik after the Aruch HaShulchan is, he wasn't alive after his death, is none other than the name is Rav Menachem Krakovsky. Rav Menachem Krakovsky is, most people know him as called the Magid Meisharim in Vilna, also as the brother-in-law of Rav Moshe Soloveitchik, the author of the work, I think he dies in 1931, the work of, it's called Avodas HaMelech on the Rambam, in which he cites his nephew, I think in three places, Rav Joseph Ber Soloveitchik, who at that time was in Berlin, and examined a manuscript of the Rambam in the Royal Library in Berlin, and sent back the text, the version, what appeared. The Menachem Krakovsky wrote to Rav Soloveitchik, asking him to check this the girsa there. And David Kamenetsky, who I mentioned last class, the great from the yeshiva world, the great scholar of the Lithuanian Torah world, just came out with a very lengthy article on Rav Menachem Krakovsky. And which is great because in the last issue of Hakira, there also was a very lengthy article, a great article on Rav Moshe Soloveitchik. So now we're getting a sense of these very interesting figures. But Rabbi, the Aruch HaShulchan was succeeded in Novartek, Baruch Nachum Krakowski. And this is interesting because where did Baruch Nachum Krakowski come from? He came from a Rabbonus that he went to Novartek. He came from a place called Chaslovich. Chaslovich, for those who know the Lithuanian Torah history, was also a Chabad, or Monshein says not such a Chabad city, but in any event, that was the Rabbonus of Ramosha Soloveitchik. So they kept it in the family. That's where J.B. Soloveitchik grew up. He goes to Warsaw from Chaslovich. That's where he had all the stories you've heard about, you know, being taught Tanya as a child by his, you know, Chabad Muhammad, and all the stories. That's Chaslovich. And there's stories as to why they always had a Misnagdish Rav there. So why do I mention all this? Because although as well as good as the relations were between the Aruch HaShulchan and the Navardic Yeshiva, that's how bad they were between his successor, Rav Menachem Krakowski. I think the problem is, and I haven't looked at Kamenetsky's article yet. He must deal with this. I printed out the article, but I haven't even looked even one page about it. It must be in there. It's a long article. The problem was Rav Menachem Krakowski had a yeshiva. The Aruch HaShulchan did not. So all of a sudden now you have two yeshivas in one city. Rav Menachem Krakowski has a yeshiva. He's an unbelievable Lamdan. And where's the yeshiva supposed to be? It's not like today where you build buildings for yeshivas everywhere you go. In those days, you know, most people were learning, you know, in shuls. So they weren't going to build a special building for him. So he said, well, I'm the Rav of the city, and this is my yeshiva. The students need to study. The yeshiva is going to be, I'm going to give shir in the main yeshiva, in the main shul. Fine. Okay. The problem was that the Navardic yeshiva was already in the main shul. And Rabbi Oizel was there. And they said, we're here first. And we were given permission. And the fact that you're the Rav of the city, it doesn't, fine. We're not going anywhere. And they refused to leave. And so what happened? What happened is the exact same thing that's happening as we speak in Ponovezh today. Rav Krakowski brought his students in there, and both Rav Krakowski and his students and the Navarik Yeshiva were learning in the shul at the same time. And you'd have competing shiurim. You have this, you can go online on YouTube and see this. You have videos of fights in the base medrash in throwing chairs even in Ponovezh. You'll have one Rebbe get up to give a shiur, and the rest of the group gets up and walks out and makes noise and things like that because they're fighting over the base medrash. It would be much better if they just open up a separate yeshiva. And by the way, both sides agree it would be much better if they open a separate yeshiva. But each side in the Ponovezh yeshiva says, yes, there should be a separate yeshiva, and you should leave and go, well, we're staying here. This is ours. So everyone is saying, kula shali. Everyone is saying it's mine. And therefore, you have people acting far from what you'd expect Torah students. Take a look, you go on YouTube and see the fight that happened last year. Throwing chairs, people could be killed in that place. There has been at least one stabbing, literally stabbing, in Ponovezh, and there's been lots of incidents of throwing of kugels at each other at meals and all sorts of things. And that's exactly what happened in the Vardic Shul. There was even physical confrontations. We'll do now that Kamenetsky has done his big article. Maybe we'll have classes on Nahum Krakowski. There's a Krakowski family in New York, and there's Eliel Krakowski, who I've had contact with. I never asked him. They're, it's some relation. So I don't know exactly the relation. There was a Krakowski who taught, I think she was the niece, or married to the nephew, I'm sorry, of Nahum Krakowski. She taught at Stern College for many years. Rabbi Chiyak of Weinberg mentions her a few times. They were close. So if anyone knows about that, she taught, I believe, French at Stern College. Okay, we're to turn to our story. Who is the grandson of the Aruch HaShulchan? Meir Bar Ilan. Meir Bar Ilan is he's the son of the Netziv, but he's also the grandson of the Aruch HaShulchan, because as remember, the second marriage of the Netziv, he married this woman much younger than him, the daughter of the Aruch HaShulchan. Now he has a book called, for some reason it's never been translated to English, and it should be. Many, many other books, much less interesting and important, have been translated to English. I think perhaps because it's too long. It's his memoirs, originally written in Yiddish, from Volusian to Jerusalem, and then in Hebrew, and they're not exactly the same, but they haven't yet appeared in English. And he speaks also about the Aruch HaShulchan and different stories and things like that. What's most important, I think, is this, that he stresses how special the Aruch HaShulchan was among the rabbis in Russia, in that, as I mentioned already, so few of them knew how to speak Russian. Those who could speak Russian were able to become crown rabbis. In every city in Russia, you had two rabbis. You had the crown rabbi, the official rabbi, the one who filled out the forms and dealt with the government. And then you had the spiritual rabbi. Where the crown rabbi, where the official rabbi, I'm sorry, where the spiritual rabbi knew Russian and could pass the test, he also could be the crown rabbi. So Rabbi Chiyak of Weinberg was a crown rabbi. Eliel Klatskin, the great Rabbi Eliel Klatskin of Lublin, who knew lots of languages, he was the crown rabbi. The Aruch HaShulchan was not the crown rabbi. I don't know, as far as I know, he wasn't the crown rabbi. I don't know why he wouldn't have been. But there wasn't really an issue with, saying, well, I'm not going to be part of that. It was a good thing. The community wanted the spiritual rabbi to be the crown rabbi, because then you wouldn't have to pay two salaries. But very few rabbis, actually, especially in those days, in the 19th century, spoke Russian. The Aruch HaShulchan was very unusual in this. And as such, he was involved, and Bar Ilan describes, Bar Ilan is Berlin, for those, and his father's, Berlin, and he becomes Bar Ilan. In his early writings, he's still Berlin. He describes how the Aruch HaShulchan was involved. He went to St. Petersburg. He was involved in governmental things. The Meir Bar Ilan was in America throughout in the teens, during the World War II era. He was involved in the Teachers Institute that's attached, the Mizrahi Teachers Institute that becomes attached to Yeshiva College. Okay, let's go on. There's a lot of things are coming to my head, but still have to move forward. Ramaimon also speaks a lot about, because that was his Rebbe, to a certain extent, about the Aruch HaShulchan. And let me just tell you a couple of things he says. He says that the Aruch HaShulchan was once asked, when we return to Eretz Yisrael and we have a Jewish state, how are you going to be able to run things in accordance with the Torah, with Shabbat? I mean, what's the, how are you going to have? You're going to have a train. These are things that just began. Train, electricity, telegraph. Supposedly, and I say supposedly because it's Maimon reporting it. Supposedly, the Aruch HaShulchan replied that if in 2,000 years the rabbis could come up with all sorts of takanot and solutions for interest, ribit, and chametz on Pesach, they will also be able to make takanot to secure Shabbos and Yom Tov. So I'm not exactly sure what that means. Maimon is telling us, Maimon, this is very important for Maimon. This is why maybe you could be skeptical. Maimon was the one, the big advocate of the Sanhedrin. He had this whole idea that the Sanhedrin can come and now we can make takanot and, bring a whole, create a state, a modern state in accordance with the halakha, but you need to make changes. And the Sanhedrin can make those changes. Because according to the Rambam, a Sanhedrin is allowed to, if it's from a drasha, for example, the Sanhedrin can make a new drasha. Much of what we do in halacha, the Chazal darshaned. So according to, you have a new Sanhedrin, you don't even have to be greater than them, you make a new drasha. Women, for instance, why is it that a woman can't be a witness for religious matters? So there's a drasha. So if we had a Sanhedrin today, they can make a new drasha that a woman could be a witness and all sorts of things. And that was the fear, the great fear in not just the Haredi world, but mostly the Haredi world, that the Sanhedrin, if Maimon was pushing, his original name was Fishman, then he changed the name Maimon, he's a big lover of the Rambam, that it was all a reformist sort of thing, that they're going to create a Sanhedrin in order to reform Judaism. But so this, what he quotes in the name of the Aruch HaShulchan, fits in very well with his own approach, although I have to say the Rabbi Maimon was an unbelievable Torah scholar. But he's very much on the outs in the traditional Torah world because of his pushing for the Sanhedrin, and also because he once came out publicly against the Brisker Rav, who was a big anti-Zionist. So let's talk a bit now about the Aruch HaShulchan's halachic legacy. of which there's been a good amount written. There's even a book, believe it or not, a small book, a man named Simcha Fishbane. He came out with a book in 2008, not a large book, not a long book. It's about 150, 160 pages. It's called The Boldness of, hold on, The Boldness of an Halachist. I don't know where the editor was because you should, in English, it should not be the boldness of an halachist. It should be the boldness of a halachist. Yes, an is put before nouns, but not a hard H. And so then the subtitle is An Analysis of the Writings of Rabbi Yechiel Mechel HaLevi Epstein. Mechel. Again, I don't know where he, the Aruch Shulchan, I don't know where he gets this. I Googled. The only one to use the word Mechel is him. The name is Mechel. Not sure where he gets Mechel from. Does anyone have the name Mechel? Any, I know there's a place in Muncie, right? A restaurant. Mechel's, but the name is Mechel. Mem Yud Chaf Lamed. That's where, if you just look on the title page of his books, Yechiel Mechel. In fact, David, I asked me in an email about the email it, David, you're here with us still. Comment, put it in again. I forgot exactly about the woman's name, which I didn't have the answer for. And I'll get to it in. You know what? I see it's already 10 o'clock. So what we're going to do, I'll stop now and comments and questions. What we'll do next time is move into the halachic legacy of Rabbi Yechiel Mechel Epstein. And despite my criticism of Fishbane, the title page, two mistakes on the title page, the book itself, don't judge the book, as I say, by a cover, don't judge the book by a title page. There's nothing groundbreaking in the book, but he has a number of interesting insights. And if we have time, I'll mention some of them because he really did study the Aruch HaShulchan. And then he has another book focusing on the Mishneh Berurah, and then he has a little bit of a comparison. So we'll get to him, but we want to talk about the halachic legacy, and that one of the first things I'll do is what I mentioned about the anti-Semitism. What I tell you, this will keep you in the suspense for next week. What I say, are you going to say that when I'm sounding just like one of the anti-Semites? Because you might say I sound like the anti-Semites, but I'm going to tell you, Ramosha Feinstein says the exact thing I'm going to tell you. Not just Ramosha Feinstein, so many others, but we'll get to that. I'm just trying to keep you in suspense, so I'm not giving it away. And we'll move on. So that's what we're going to do. We're going to start looking at his halachic legacy next class. And in addition to that, it's not just the Aruch HaShulchan, it's this really interesting book, which I don't know if people know this, the Kisvei Aruch HaShulchan, which includes material, other material, including his famous response, not a responsum, I should say, his famous halachic, I guess, tshuva, yeah, responsum about electricity on Yom Tov, which certain people wanted to cover up, apparently, and but we'll get to all this. So let me go back now and, okay, just a couple of comments. Yes, Shimon mentions Tosefes Bracha, which is a very good book. Look, even if it's the case that all, I can't imagine everything, but even if the case that most of it, even if all of it is taken from other people, he puts together all sorts of interesting things. Moshe Feinstein, he says the Satmar Rebbe would consider Zaken Mamre. Yeah, that's Rav Henkin. Rav Henkin says the Satmar Rebbe would consider the Zaken Mamre. Because all the other Gedolim were against it. And also because he was doing things that Rabbi Henkin thought were endangering the Jews living in the state of Israel. I mean, protests in front of the, you know, if you have a protest, if you get 50,000, let's say, Satmar people, or 20, there were 50,000 in those days. But in those days, let's say, if you get 10,000 Satmars to come down to Washington, D.C. and protest in front of the White House, then they look out and they see us and say, you know what? Maybe there isn't such backing. When I think it was our new congresswoman. We, for those who are in Canada, let me let you in on something here. We've always had liberals, leftists, and everything in Congress of different sorts, but we've always, everyone has supported Israel. Yeah, you've had liberals, you've had Obama people, but basically, they always believed in either the two-state solution, support of Israel, even the most leftists. Now we have a situation where, for the first time in American history, we have two Congress people who do not support the existence of the state of Israel. They believe it should just go away, and that's. And I remember saying a few years ago, in one of my talks, I give this talk on Islam. It's only a matter of time because you're having a enormous Muslim growth in demographic growth in Michigan and in Minnesota, and that's the two ones we have. And I remember Election Day, I said this to my class in Scranton. I teach world religions, and one of the things we deal with is Islam. I said that everyone is talking about the great diversity and it's how wonderful. Two Muslim congressmen, and I said to them that us in the Jewish community are not so thankful because both of them are very anti-Israel, and this is going to come back to haunt us. In any event, the one from Minnesota said, in speaking about her attitude towards Israel, she says, and there are certain Jewish scholars that agree with me as well. What you talking about, Jewish scholars? Well, obviously, she saw on TV that you had 50,000 Satmars protesting in New York against the state of Israel. Don't believe that Zionism is racism. And that Zionism is against the Torah. So now you have a congresswoman, she could be anti-Israel now, oppose the existence of the state of Israel, and say that, I'm going along with what these, as she said, Jewish scholars are saying. So that's, if that's not being a Zaken Mamre, I don't know what is. That's what Rav Henkin was referring to. And Rav Henkin could say it because Rav Henkin was an anti-Zionist before the war. He wasn't one of these Lithuanians who was a pro-Zionist or on the fence. He was actually anti-Zionist. Just like the Lubavitcher Rebbe, once the state is declared, how can you be anti now? Because now we're talking about 6, 7 million Jewish lives at risk. So that's why he said he was Zaken Mamre. And he says it doesn't, remember his grandson, it doesn't say anything about his sitkus or his scholarship. It's just a technical thing. Look, the Zaken Mamre were also a great Talmidei Chachamim. So let's go on. What else do we have here? They made sense. Shimon says going to the same story as they go to a pharmacy and ask for milk. So I guess the equivalent would be you call up your local pizzeria and ask to make a reservation or something. They or you go in there to the local pizza shop and say, can my waiter come to my table? They'll look at you like you're crazy. This is a pizzeria. It's all about destroying your self-image and getting rid of your humiliating yourself. They once asked a question to them because they'd walk around with dirty clothes, so they wouldn't feel so great about themselves. But the Rambam says that if a Talmid Chacham walks around with a stain on his garment, he's chayav misa, he's deserving of the death penalty because people look at this and say, this is the Torah. You're supposed to represent the Torah in a good way. And the answer supposedly that came back was that the Rambam is only referring to if your whole shirt is white or clean and you have one stain. But if the whole shirt is stained, then he's not talking about that, which of course it's hard to imagine that they ever would have said that. It's more likely they said that we don't hold with the Rambam in it, because obviously if one stain, you're chayav misa, if you walk around with all those stains, you are. Ira G says, Yitz Greenberg can give you personal anecdotes from his early yeshiva influences. Thank you, Ira, for pointing it out. A lot of people blame YU for Yitz Greenberg. Yitz Greenberg, who in the word of Revara Lichtenstein, actually, I don't remember the exact words. I'm not going to say it. But Yitz Greenberg created all these problems, and it's known that he was part of the modern Orthodox world. He taught at YU. He was close to, he was a rabbi, by the way, in Brookline, Massachusetts, and he was close to the Rav. So they blame YU when he never studied with the Rav. Formally, he was never from YU. He comes from the Vardik. In fact, on the Pesach program I go to, run by the Feskowitz family, I got some very good story. He was a big Talmid Chacham, Yitz Greenberg, but Moshe Feskowitz, Rabbi Moshe Feskowitz, is one of the Rabbanim there because his son runs the program. Rabbi Moshe Feskowitz is the that's the family, the Navardic family. The Yafin, his grandfather is Rabbi Yafin from America. That's also in Eliashiva Karlbach's family. So yes, so Yitz Greenberg was from Navardic. The Zaks family, Moshe says, don't take them out. I'm not sure take what out, so remind me. Ben Sienberg didn't take them out. Now Moshe says Yehuda had Gordon Shomer Shabbos. No, these were not Shomer Shabbos. And but Lillian Bloom was not Shomer Shabbos. Achad Ha'am wasn't Shomer Shabbos either. Bialik was, I wouldn't say he was not a Shomer Shabbos, he was a Mechabed Shabbos, I think you could say. So there's no question you had, certainly as time went further, you had Maskilim who were completely irreligious. Yehuda Leib Gordon was in Shavli together with Yosef Zecharia Stern. However, you also had many so-called Maskilim who were very observant, especially from the in the mid-19th century. In the mid-19th century, the Mechallel Shabbos were the minority. As the century goes on, you have irreligiosity spreads. Achad Ha'am, actually, they don't even regard him and Bialik as Maskilim. They're sort of already, into the more the Zionist phase. But there were definitely Maskilim who were irreligious. But and they would write for these newspapers as well. That's a fact. That the same newspapers would, so maybe it's like the Jewish Week today. But if you go to a place like Kovno, or Vilna, these Maskilim would go. Many of them would go to shul also when they were Shomer Shabbos. Does that mean they didn't carry handkerchiefs? That I can't say. But they were not Mechallel Shabbos, but for Hesiod, by opening stores, things of that nature. Meant you had many, many examples of Maskilim like that. The Mar Cheshes's father was an example, very interesting. The Mar Cheshes on the Beis Din of Vilna, Rav Chenoch Aigis, Rabbi Zevin makes an interesting comment that normally the phenomenon is the father is the Talmud Chacham and the son's the Maskil. With the Mar Cheshes, it was the exact opposite. The father was the Maskil and the son was the Talmud Chacham. But the father was also a Talmud Chacham. So I only mention this because we're not talking about other places like in Germany. But if you think of in Lithuania and think of Maskilim, you can't just say Maskilim. The Russian Matisyahu Strashon is a Maskil, right in Vilna. And yet he's a huge Talmud Chacham, and his father was a quasi Maskil, the Rashash as well. And so you have many examples of people like this who were Haskalah oriented, but were also very respectful of tradition, even Harkavi. Harkavi and as people the Netziv had contact, I'm sorry, Rabbi Yitzchak Aharon had contact with many of these people. So that was my only point that just to be called a Maskil in Lithuania, remember what it says? Yes, Hil Kazor HaRakia. The word Maskil can mean in the Sephardic world, they refer to people as Hamaskil, a Rav Hamaskil, and it doesn't mean a heretic or anything. Let me go on. The Aruch HaShulchan, the response was published in Hatzfira. The reason it was published in Hatzfira, I'll tell you right now, is because the original article was published in Hatzfira. So and the original article was by Rav Avraham Borstein. You can. Quotes the article here. It must have been yeah. So the original article was published in Hatzfira. This also was controversial because by putting for a rabbi like Rabbi Borstein and the other rabbis to you put their criticism in Hatzfira, that's in front of all the non-religious and all the maskilim as well. But they didn't have their own newspapers, so that was and we've seen plenty of examples in the Jewish Week. Of Orthodox disputes going on in the Jewish week in front of everyone. So I think probably that's a good example. David Eisen says, for the past 30 years, the Merkus Rav students typically wear white shirts all week to the extent that the line and other religious yeshivas. The question is, how does the Merkus Negev Shabbat takes a pen out of his shirt? David, I don't know. I hate to disagree because I mean, I was in Merkus last year. When I was in Israel, and Rav Yaakov Shapiro's own son was not wearing a white shirt. He was wearing a regular shirt. And Rav Dadon, I've spoken about him, the author of so many of the books that come out of Americans, was not wearing a white shirt. And I was in the room where they do the Halacha Berurah, and they weren't wearing white shirts. I'm not saying there aren't any who don't, and I'm not a student at Americans, but when I go to Israel, I make an effort to go to Merkaz because many of the books that I buy, you can't really get them. You have to go buy them right there. And I just was there. It wasn't that long ago. and it was a few months ago. It was last summer, and they were not looking like they look when you go to the mir, or even Kisei Rachamim. I went to the Kisei Rachamim Yeshiva either. So correct me, David, if I'm wrong, but I was just there, and they were not wearing white shirts, all of them. Maybe there were some, but I only remember the ones I was talking to, and they were not wearing white shirts. It could have been the others were wearing white shirts. So it could be that that's only in a generalization. And they definitely don't. I'm going to fall off my tra chair, David, if you tell me that on Shabbos now they're wearing jackets and hats. Okay, so David pointed out the wife of the Rosh Hashanah, Micha, here in her. I'll tell you right now. There's no discussion about the name here. He asked me about the name. Where does that name come from? I'm assuming it's a feminine of Michal. But I'm still waiting for someone to explain to me why Yechiel and Michal were placed together. Michla, or they spell it Mem Yud Chaf Lamed Hey, or feminine of Michal, perhaps. It's obviously not the feminine of Michal. It's the feminine of Michal, but Michal is Michal, I believe. Wasn't Fishbane the one who printed the last volume of the Erech Shulchan? He was. We're going to talk about the Erech Shulchan, this last volume that only appeared about 20 years ago. He was indeed the one, and his brother is one of the rabbis in the CRC in Chicago. Why are there so little response of his extant? Excellent question. We'll get to it next class. Everyone should be wondering this. The Erech Shulchan, one of the leading poskim, how come we don't have Shelos and Shuvos of the Erech Shulchan? Oh, you're saying Moshe says they don't take out their tzitzis. Zach's family, that's interesting. Zach's family doesn't. Couple more questions. Diane, Atzvira is parallel to Melitz in the German colony. All these Jew Hebrew newspapers have streets in Israel. Okay, you're saying not all the students, tongue in cheek. Okay, no jackets or hats. And Diane says, and we'll leave this as the last question, what does this anything have to do with being a real scholar and a good Jew? It's a good question, but Diane, I think you're missing the point. No one says that by wearing a hat or a jacket, you're more of a scholar or anything. It has to do with camaraderie. It has to do with esprit de corps. So why is it that when you go to a yeshiva, you dress this way? Because this has become the dress code. So what it says is that you're in the club. In fact, many of the people in the yeshivas, when they're not in yeshiva, when they're on vacation, I even saw them on Pesach, they don't wear the garb. Others wear it all the time. I know that in the modern Orthodox world, they get very annoyed by this, especially when they see in YU, you walk in the YU base medrash and you have guys with black hats and white shirts. It doesn't bother me because first of all, if they moved to Israel, they wouldn't dress like that because in Israel it's so much more political. But second of all, despite the black hats and the white shirts, they're Zionists. They believe in edge of college, etc. But every society has uniforms. YU has a uniform also. You don't go. My students in the spring will come dressed in shorts. Would you do that at YU? No. So everyone has a uniform. The yeshiva world, how it developed. It used to not be black. It became black. For good or for bad, that's now the uniform, so much so that even the Sephardic world, they have adopted that. That has become the uniform, which they think is the sign of a serious Torah student. So it's not about being a good Jew or being a real scholar. I know how many people I know in the Haredi world, we have them listening to us right now. None of them have ever said to me, none of them have ever implied that it has anything to do with being a good Jew or anything like that. But in their world, that's what it means to be a participant in their society. That's all. And I mean this in all seriousness, that real Haredim will not say that you're not a good Jew if you don't wear a hat. What they'll say is that you're not in the best Torah community to put forth values. But they're not going to say that you're not a good Jew or certainly not a real scholar. But it's all part, being a part of a community is different than, dress is also part of a community, and it's all about creating an environment, which maybe we think is crazy, because I mean, this is what you're paying attention to, these insignificant things. If you go to Square, you can't be a member of the new Square community unless you wear, I think they have certain boots. I mean, all sorts of, every community has their mishigas. But from the non-Orthodox, they look at the Orthodox and they also see it as some of the things we do as crazy. So every community has their stuff. I've always been pleasantly surprised by people, real yeshivish people, when they leave the environment, when they're on vacation, other places, they don't feel the need to dress that way. And they'll tell you that, in the community during the Zman, that's different than on vacation. So I can get it. If you're in the military, when you're on duty, you would dress one way. And when you're on vacation, you dress another way. It doesn't really bother me. Does that make me a Haredi wannabe? I don't know. But it doesn't really, this levush doesn't bother me so much so. And I'll end with this. And I know the modern Orthodox hate it, but I'm going to say it. I actually like when rabbanim and shuls wear the levush, because for good or bad, it's, and Ratzvi Yehuda Cook said the same thing. This has become the garb of what it means to be a rav. So I actually like it. I don't like it when the masses wear it, because why should they look like a Rosh Yeshiva? Who are they? But I like when the rabbis, when I see the rabbi, even in modern Orthodox shul, with the rabbi with the hat and everything, I happen to like it. So I don't know. That makes me a turncoat, maybe. It doesn't make me. Some people are going to be sending me annoying emails after that. But I actually like it, because every position has an all every role. It's nice to have a uniform, and that's the uniform of a rav. It's true that great rabbanim didn't wear the uniform. Chaim Soloveitchik never wore the levush, but. And that's why, if you look in Merkaz, of this, the Rabbanim in Merkaz, most of them wear Rav Yaakov Ariel, one of the great Talmidei Chachamim of our day. He wears the uniform because Ratzvi Yehuda Cook said, when you're a Rav, you should wear the uniform. And he's Rav Shmuel Eliyahu, they wear the uniform. It doesn't, but only the rabbis do. Okay. Yes, even the Reform had clerical robes, and even the Orthodox had clerical robes years ago as well. So thank you all for this, Diane, especially for the final comment to end it. We have a Fensterheim, there's Fensterheims in Scranton. It's one of the Rebbeim in the yeshiva in Scranton. His name, Fensterheim. Good night, everyone.